If you type the word leadership into Amazon or any other consumer-driven book website, you will be besieged by legions of primers and manuals on the subject, aimed primarily at the business sector. Some of them sound eminently serious and perfectly readable. The New Leaders, Transforming the Art of Leadership into the Science of Results, for example, sounds perfectly readable. Others betray a potentially baffling fondness for buzzwords. Take, for example, The Leadership Pipeline, How to Build the Leadership-Powered Company. There are even more extreme examples which seem so desperate to grab our attention that they sound like hysterical pitches for Hollywood movies. My favourite being Silos, Politics and Turf Wars, a leadership fable about destroying the barriers that turn colleagues into competitors. Mm. Plenty to chew on there, and probably much to choke on. It would seem that in this day and age, the art of leadership, or indeed the science of leadership, has become regarded as an essential subject for study by those placed or seeking to place themselves in a position of authority over others. It's not just princes and potentates, as in Machiavelli's day, who need pointers, but anyone at the head of a chain of command, whether it be in the field of politics, running a company, or indeed running a restaurant. I would just, before we move on to Shakespeare, or introduce Shakespeare to this particular theme, I really wanted to ask the panel first what they had to say about leadership in the modern age, in the 21st century. Lord Smith, Chris Smith, you have just written an article for the New Statesman about Shakespeare and leadership, and you do allude very early on in that piece to the sheer number of primers that there are out there on the subject of leadership. Do you think there is a particular interest at the moment in leadership? Is there a sort of sudden splurge of excitement about the subject?
Not particularly a sudden splurge. It's been going on for quite a number of years. And you're absolutely right. There are something like 2,000 books on leadership published every year. Most of them, I hasten to add, are not worth reading. And most of them consist of lists. You know, here is the range of skills you need to have in order to be a good leader. And I could entertain you for the next hour just by giving you lists of the three C's and the four Y's and all those. And most of these lists consist of a range of things like being able to have and articulate a vision, encapsulating mission statements, be a public advocate, build teams, take difficult decisions, etc., 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 etc. Actually, fairly common sense things about running any sort of large organization. There is a difference between running a big organization or being at the head of a big organization and being a good leader. And the art of being a good leader is something that, on the whole, you know when you see. And one of the wonderful things about Shakespeare, which we will hopefully get onto in a minute or two, is that really, there are so many different thoughts about leadership spread across the whole canon of Shakespeare. There is no one thing that you can say, this is what Shakespeare says good leadership is, because actually what he's doing is looking at the issue of leadership and very often kingship from a whole variety of different viewpoints. But I do think there are some threads that you can draw out and you can say, there are some lessons here for us to learn. Let me just say, over the last 3 years, I've been running this rather wonderful thing called the CLAW Leadership Program, which is about helping to develop a new generation of leaders for the cultural sector, right across the piece, from museums and galleries to theatres and orchestras and opera houses. And through all of the thinking and listening and talking and discussing about leadership that I've done over that three-year period, there are really two absolutely central things that have come through to me. And actually, they come through to me when I read Shakespeare as well, which sort of makes me think I'm probably on the right lines. And that is that the two absolutely key ingredients for good leadership are, number one, know and understand yourself. Know what deep down you are, you believe in, what your strengths and values are. Because if you don't do that, then you cannot dare to lead other people. That's rule number one. And number two, leadership is not about being at the head of something and telling people what to do. Leadership is being at the heart of an organization and bringing people with you. And it is actually all about building relationships. I take my... one of the wonderful things about no longer being in government is you can be rather more candid about things that are happening. take John Reed and the Home Office. The Home Office isn't working terribly well, but the last thing you need to do if you're going to try and get the Home Office working well is tell everyone in the Home Office publicly that they're terrible. What you need to do is start to build the relationships within the team that will then produce the successful action. And so in thinking about Shakespeare and thinking about what Shakespeare does with leaders and leadership, it seems to me that those two fundamental thoughts, know yourself and build relationships, are the things we need to bear in mind.
Okay, well, we'll come on to the Bard in a minute. Liz Fraser, that's in a sense, there's quite a lot of common sense coming through in that opening description. And quite obviously, it's very easy to lose sight of the most basic principles of human interaction when you're governing or you're leading. Do you think there is a... Are we in a particular moment of curiosity and also confusion about what entails a good leader at the moment? And is it, and also in addition to that, because you have a huge range of experience talking about gender and politics, are we at a crossroads in terms of where what might constitute male leadership, female leadership, whether those distinctions don't matter? What's your take on
that? Sure. I mean, I think, like Chris, I think that it's been going on for a long time, and it's been going on over decades, that there's been a loss of confidence in hierarchy and the sort of model of command and control, which did work or seemed to work in many institutions, economic, social and political institutions for a long time. And our model of the leader was the commander. That post-60s becomes then intensely suspicious to many, many people. Many people then associate that with unacceptable levels of authoritarianism, talk to numerous perfectly sensible people about leadership, and they think of Hitler or Mussolini, they think of fascism, they think of authoritarianism, and they don't want to have anything to do with it. And lots of progressive political movements and reforming and crusading political movements have tried to do it, so to speak, without leadership. The leaderless group becomes an ideal for organisation and so on. So throughout the population, we have an intense suspicion of leadership. We lack then, I think, convincing models of the leader, because obviously the fascist Führer is absolutely no good. We then turn to different sort of prominent people, the star. Well, we don't really want stardom because stars just want all the attention on themselves. They're not thinking about the team. We think about the priest or the very, very wise person or the magician, the person who can make things happen. And obviously they're no good because they're not democratic enough. And I think, you can proliferate these sort of candidate models of leadership that we have in our culture and in our lives. And for every single one of them, we've got an extremely good reason to reject them. Then we've got this ideal that Chris has just articulated, which is the person who is leading from the centre, who's not asking people to do anything that they wouldn't do themselves, who is attentive to networks and social relationships and knows about the dynamics of the group that they're trying to lead, go with. And we don't actually have a very vivid cultural representation of that person, I think. I mean, I think one thing is that we don't really find that person in Shakespeare. And actually, when you think about it, how we would represent that figure culturally is quite a conundrum. We don't meet them in novels, and we don't meet them very much in cinema and plays because they're not terribly visual. But anyway, I think that's an issue that we've got about the culture of leadership. It's how to represent them culturally in this vivid way that we can represent the magician, for example. But yeah, I mean, I think there is a crisis of leadership. I think we don't know what we want from it. We don't like being bossed about. Who does? Some people like bossing about, and the people who like bossing about are the ones you wouldn't want to boss anybody. You know, it's that sort of paradox of power thing. I think that there just is a crisis, and the business schools aren't resolving the situation for us. That's for sure.
That's fascinating. So in a way, maybe we'll snake back to the whole question about whether we are being governed at the moment, whether anything is governing us, whether one person is enough, or one leader is enough. Josie, in a sense, you're quite well equipped to sort of test out some of the remarks that have just been made, because you are, effectively, you're a leader, aren't you? You're a director of a company. You've got to stand in front of a group of people and persuade them to do some things some way, so your way sometimes. I mean, is that how you feel? Do you feel you're a leader?
Yeah, I mean, listening to Chris list those two central pillars, if you like, of leadership, I can feel my blood beginning to run cold in terms of how successful I am at achieving or not achieving it with a company of actors. And indeed, I'm in a fascinating situation at the moment, because I'm doing what I did last year with the RSC, which is that I'm coming in to a company who's already performed two plays together. Wow. So normally, as a director, as I'm sure many of you know, what happens is that you choose your actors. Well, I was involved in choosing the actors who are doing Much Ado in Romeo and Juliet and then going to come on and do King John with me, but that was 6 months ago, so they've all forgotten meeting me at the RSC offices in London. And of course, the bit of a director that is so fascinating, which is watching, exactly as Liz was saying, those social interactions begin to happen, observing where friendships are being formed or people deciding that they're antithetical to either someone in the room or a bit of the work that you're trying to encourage people to do, that bit, if you come in late, you miss out on. And Greg Doran actually says of directing, which I think is a wonderful and terrifying thing to say, that it's tyranny masquerading as democracy. And it's terribly hard when you come into a rehearsal room with a group of actors who've already formed those relationships not to seem like you're simply coming there to boss them about, because you don't get to form a part of those initial key discoveries that they make when they decide whether they like each other or not and how they're going to proceed with the work. So that's been fascinating, and is thrown sharply into relief by the idea of thinking about Shakespeare and leadership.
Well, maybe we should we can't ignore the fact that Shakespeare and leadership, that's the title, and Shakespeare is in a sense, where do you start when you think Shakespeare and leadership? So it seems like any play that Shakespeare writes, there are going to be power relations, there's going to be somebody in charge at some level. My way of kind of cutting a sway through the canon is to say that there are clearly plays where that you'd have no hesitation in describing key characters as leaders. And among the early middle plays from 1588 to 1603 up to the end of Elizabeth's reign, you have a plethora of kings. King John, Richard II, Henry IV, Henry V, Henry VI, Richard III, and right at the end of the career, we get Henry VIII. All these plays are quite explicitly about the acquisition and the exercise of power, and they're also about England. And it's hard to see how you could talk about Shakespeare without and leadership without thinking about them. And of the remainder of the canon, there may be other ideas coming here from the panel, but I want to throw in Measure for Measure, Othello, King Lear, Macbeth, Antony and Cleopatra, and Coriolanus. Well, given the allotted timescale of this brunch, we're really going to be able to have about 2 minutes per play at that rate. But I think one thing stands out from that selection, which is that with the exception of Henry IV, Henry V, and Henry VIII, possibly you could include Measure for Measure, although I doubt it, things work out unhappily for the leaders in question. King John is poisoned, the deposed imprisoned Richard II stabbed to death, the deposed imprisoned Henry VI is murdered by Richard, Duke of York, who in turn is slain by the future Henry VII at Bosworth. Lear, Othello, Macbeth, Antony, Cleopatra all come a cropper in ways we need scarcely to rehearse. So an initial observation would be, and this is, as it were, from somebody who hasn't been in power, would be that if today's leaders or would-be leaders look at the bard at all, he doesn't make much in the way of comfort in reading. most of the figures in powers he looks at are either unequal to or defeated by the position they occupy. So you could argue that Shakespeare has located a pattern of inevitable failure in the business of government, and the business of leadership, and at the particular life cycle of the New Labour government, it's quite an interesting moment to ask whether there are certain inevitable failures built into the business of running a country, running a system of power. Two quotes I wanted to throw in, I won't gabble on much more, but the two quotes I really wanted to put your way, to hold in your head. One was Francis Bacon writing an essay entitled Of Great Power. He wrote this in about 1612, we think. Men in great places are thrice servants, servants of the sovereign or state, servants of fame, and servants of business. So as they have no freedom, neither in their persons, nor in their actions, nor in their times. It is a strange desire to seek power and to lose liberty, or to seek power over others and to lose power over a man's self. The rising unto place is laborious, and by pains men come to greater pains. And it is sometimes base, and by indignities men come to dignities. The standing is slippery, and the regress is either a downfall or at least an eclipse, which is a melancholy thing. So we're not really that far away from Richard II, actually seen to, and you probably know the lines, but it's worth repeating a few of them. For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings, how some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed, some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping killed, all murdered. For within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king keeps death his court. At the end of that speech, he says, throw away respect, tradition, form, and ceremonious duty, for you have but mistook me all this while. I live with bread like you, feel want, taste grief, need friends. Subjected thus, how can you say to me, I am a king?